Hello, everyone. This is our sixth, is it the sixth tutorial that we're having? I hope I'm in the right place. This is Barbara Fields, Executive Director of Association for Global New Thought, and I'm here with Jim Kenny. Hello, Jim.
Hi.
Our engineer of our conference call today is Megan Stanek. She's the assistant for Association for Global New Thought. Reverend Donna Burns is here. And all of you are here, and I see more names. The reason we started just a little late is we saw a lot of people signing on, and we wanted to give it a couple of minutes to start so that we wouldn't have to start over again. But I welcome all of you to the sixth tutorial, and I see many familiar names here. I see a couple of new names for people who have registered recently. So we welcome you to our little family, because that's what it's beginning to feel like. And just wanted to tell you before we begin our tutorial today that this conference is getting very exciting from where we sit. You know, we're devoting most of our time to it now every day, Jim and I and Megan and Hillary and musicians and trustees, people who have really been key to the planning process. And I'm talking to a lot of you who are registering for the conference as part of our action group, as well as interacting with core group leaders and getting to know people and their skills and their projects and what they bring and how they feel. And I had to say something because I feel like I'm kind of starting to burst with the excitement of knowing who we really are as a group and what we're really going to be capable of accomplishing when we meet all together in Italy in October. So it gives me even more juice for these tutorials because I feel we're learning a lot. I feel like we're building our community. And I'm just hoping that all of you who come to the calls are gaining as much from them as we do in putting them together and listening to the interviews and so on. So before we begin, we always like to do something of a centering moment or a centering meditation or prayer moment. And I'm thinking we usually either call for volunteers or surprise someone. I'm thinking that I'm going to surprise Mr. Stephen Pope, my husband Stephen, who's from the Quaker tradition, and ask Stephen if he'll be willing to open today's festivities.
Well, Quakers are most renowned for being silent, Barbara, so you're just doing this to make me be silent in front of other people, right? No, what I'd like to do is one of our theories also is just, I'm for some reason thinking of Sogyal Rinpoche, the Tibetan teacher's teaching about that the mind is like a bowl of water with some dirt in it, and as long as you keep stirring it, it will be muddy, and as soon as you stop stirring it, its nature is to be clear. And the dirt will just settle to the bottom and you'll have clear water. So I would just invite everyone to keep an image of something being stirred and then left to settle and see if that helps you quiet your mind and focus on what we're going to be talking about today.
Oh, thank you. Not bad for a Quaker.
Thank you all. I'd like to introduce you to one other piece of Quaker lore, which is when we hold somebody in good feelings or wish the best for someone, we call it holding them in the light. So I would just invite you all to hold Barbara and Jim and their guest in the light for the next few weeks while they put together this huge event.
Thank you. I will definitely accept that. And in fact, I like the idea that as we approach this and we think about it with our minds and we think about our logistics and we think about getting together in community and we research our topics, I don't think many of us need this reminder, but it probably also is the perfect time to start holding it in the light, knowing that what we are doing is creating a sacred space in which to be in community, have our discussions, and most of all, to look at these challenging topics and issues, not from the typically politically secular stand that has gotten us, frankly, into a lot of trouble because it doesn't have a holistic or an interdependent approach, but to be creating a sense of the sacred as we move toward those discussions, because that's really what spiritually motivated activism is all about. So, that said, I'm thinking that...
Stephen, this is Jim, and I just want to say that, first of all, thank you for the holding in the light thing. And I love the stirring thing. That's new for me, and it worked in just that brief time. Thanks.
Well, that's from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Sogyal. He uses that.
And I know the book well, but I had long forgotten that. Thanks.
Wow. I look forward to a lot more of this to come. Let's take a moment now to do what we've been doing that's been a great part of the call in the past, which is just take a little bit of time in smaller groups. I'd say, Megan, maybe let's put us in groups of three, if that works. You can judge how many we are total on the call and figure that out. But rather than bothering you all at this point with some of you are new to this process where you just are in a smaller group for a few minutes, getting to know people that you'll be meeting up with at the conference. And as we go through the tutorials time after time, people are getting to meet more of the folks that are going to be part of their community in Italy. So one of the things that we'd like to do now is, instead of bothering you with bells about who should be talking at what point, I think we'll just go into the groups and take a moment to introduce yourselves by name so that you'll know who's there. And then if we're in groups of how many? One, two,
three.
Take about, figure about a couple of minutes each. That will probably take about 6 minutes in order to complete this part and introduce ourselves and have some conversation. So as soon as you hear the bell, just introduce yourself by name and then just go into whatever's on top for you. You can talk about what you do. You can talk about an experience. It's completely up to you, whatever is calling you right now. Okay, let's begin that, and then we'll come back and begin the rest of our tutorial.
You are now in a breakout. Please begin.
Okay, good. Welcome back. I hope that was enjoyable. So now let's move into the meaty part of our tutorial today. And the religious tradition that we're discussing today, as you know, is the Baha'i tradition. And some of the general themes have to do with forgiveness. If any of you had time to view our video meditation with quotations from religion and scripture of the various traditions, 13 of them, actually. So we're going to follow our format and have Jim begin by introducing us to what we want to know about Baha'i tradition and then move into the interviews. Jim?
Okay, great. And one nice thing is that we have one of our interviews tonight is with Charles Nolley, who has been a major figure in the U.S. Baha'i community for some time and is a very close friend of Barbara's and mine, and it will be instructive. But what we've done, as I think most of you know, with all of these intros to the world's religions, is present just a little paragraph summary, and then we've asked of each religion, what is its excellence? That's, as I like to repeat each time, based on the notion from a wonderful book called The Transcendent Unity of Religions, written in about 1976 by a Swiss named Fritjof Schuon. He said this, he said, every religion is superior to every other by virtue of something it does best. And what a refreshing idea that is. So in each session, We've asked, what's the excellence of this tradition? What's its master story? What's the story that it tells most often and best? What's a characteristic ritual pattern? And what's one of its chief ethical norms? So let me just read this short paragraph on the Baha'i faith. Founded by the Persian nobleman Baha'u'llah in the 19th century, the Baha'i faith is one of the world's fastest growing. It teaches that humanity is actually a single race and that the time for global unity has come. Baha'i faith affirms the spiritual and ethical teachings of all the great religious traditions while offering new principles appropriate to an emerging global civilization. Baha'is regard Baha'u'llah as a divine messenger in a line that includes Abraham and Moses, and Buddha, Zoroaster, Christ, and Muhammad. In the words of Baha'u'llah, the earth is but one country and mankind its citizens. I should mention here that one of the things that we've been talking about as we've been going along on this business of religions of the world is the idea that there are three basic ways to look at the multiplicity of religions. You can either be an exclusivist who believes that because your religion is true, the others must be false, or you can be an inclusivist who believes that your religion is truer than any of the others, but that one or more of the others is true enough, is close enough that salvation is possible for its members. The generous inclusivist believes that all people of good faith will be saved, even though his or her tradition is the truest. So Christianity is an example of an inclusivist faith, so is Islam. And finally, there is the pluralist, and the pluralist is one who believes that more than one religion can be completely valid and completely true, even if their word stories appear to be in contradiction. The pluralist, by the way, is not a relativist, doesn't believe that everything is true that anyone says, believes that false religions are possible, but believes that there can be well more than one completely valid, completely true faith. Baha'i is often regarded as a pluralist vision, and actually that's not quite correct. It is an inclusivism, which is to say that Baha'i believes that its formulation is the clearest, the truest, the most advanced, but that all of the other great religions are also valid paths to salvation. So it really is a religion for the 21st century. The excellence of Baha'i that we've identified is its profound commitment, and this is backed up by global effort, I can tell you from personal experience, a profound commitment to global peace and unity, and to the understanding that human evolution is inexorably linked to spiritual development, to intercultural harmony as the touchstone of our planetary future. So Baha'is have been involved in the kind of work we're all doing, this interreligious, intercultural work, from the get-go. They're always there. They're always pulling their weight. And we've all of us who are in the interreligious movement have worked closely with Baha'i partners. The master story is the story of the Bab, the forerunner of Baha'u'llah, as the bearer of a long-awaited divine revelation. His name actually means the gate. Baha'i is a religion that is born in the soil of Islam, but is not regarded by Baha'is as a further development of Islam, but as a brand new and fresh revelation that is born in that soil. And finally, the last two, a characteristic ritual pattern of Baha'i is daily prayer, and they're very faithful about this, and scripture reading. Scripture reading, daily prayer. It's interesting to ask of various faith communities how well people know their scriptures. Baha'is know their scripture very, very well. And finally, their ethical norm, and this is to be celebrated and congratulated, is service to all humankind. And I can tell you once again, as Barbara can from experience, that Baha'is live up to this. Okay.
Great. So let's, in that spirit, Charles Nolley, who is a friend and colleague of Jim and mine for quite a long time. I first met him at the Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1993, and Jim, you knew him long before that, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I,
Charles,
but I do
and I
know,
were.
No, please introduce him a little bit, because I do know that he was one of its, you know, most capable spokespeople, and that he was, in my mind, always a complete emblem of someone who not only knew a lot about his own tradition and was an excellent community leader, but also you could feel in Charles that he lived his spirituality very, very precisely day in and day out.
Yeah, Charles and I both happened to be present at the meeting in 1988, a meeting of about 10 people, at which we discussed the idea of a celebration of the 1893 Parliament of the World's Religions, and we formed the Council for a Parliament of the World's Religions and elected ourselves to the board and went ahead to elect Charles as the first executive director of the Parliament. He was that night the obvious choice, and we were never disappointed. He was a gem. I see him from time to time. He is a champion of interfaith work. And so he was a natural when we were, a couple of years ago, when Barbara asked me to help put together a list of representatives of different traditions that we might interview and get a deeper sense of those traditions. And so when we came to Baha'i, Charles Nolley was a natural, and we talked to him. And what I am struck most by as I go back to that call and to that interview is something connected to our theme for tonight. And our theme is forgiveness and reconciliation. And so I asked Charles, why is forgiveness such an important concept in Baha'i? Let me just read you a little bit of what he had to say. He said, forgiveness is a fundamentally important concept from any perspective you want to take. At every level and in every religious tradition, forgiveness is important. But the greatest benefit comes to the person who forgives. In the Baha'i writings, there's a tablet that talks about the vastness of the universe and the insignificance of our planet in relation to the whole. There's an idea we've all thought about. Charles continues that in the Baha'i writings, it goes on to say that when these stainless souls, such as Jesus, appear in the world, they affect the whole universe. When he, in particular, gave his life on the cross, every atom in this vast universe wept, and that was a redemption that infused the entire creation with a fresh capacity to drive forward this process of evolution so that human spirits can rise to higher levels of refinement. And one more little bit. This is a direct quote from Baha'u'llah. Breathe not the sins of others, so long as thou art thyself a sinner. I love the phrasing. Breathe not the sins of others, so long as thou art thyself a sinner. Shouldst thou transgress this command, accursed would thou be, and to this I bear witness. Ascribe not to any soul that which thou wouldst not have ascribed to thee, and say not that which thou doest not. Love the creatures for the sake of God and not for themselves. You will never become angry or impatient if you love them for the sake of God. Humanity is not perfect. There are imperfections in every human being, and you will always become unhappy if you look toward the people themselves. But if you look toward God, you will love them and be kind to them. For the world of God is the world of perfection and complete mercy. Therefore, don't look to the shortcomings of anybody. See with the sight of forgiveness. Powerful stuff.
That's really powerful stuff. And one thing that struck me when I actually read that very passage, the idea of loving creatures for the sake of God and not for themselves, I had to admit that I understood it in its context, but I also struggled with it a little because my understanding of that concept and what I try to practice in my life is that there's a difference in perception and acceptance when one is seeing beyond the ego or the personality of another human being and actually seeing the human being as an absolute expression of the divine, however you conceive that to be. And sometimes I can't really understand as well in the context of an externalized deity as I can understanding from the point of view of the God within or the divine or the sacred impulse within us. And so I believe that what he's saying is the same thing that I'm understanding, which is it's not really for the sake of an externalized God that you would want to perceive your fellow human beings in this way. It's actually a transcendence of appearances, of ego and personality, that allows you not to see the essence because it belongs to an objectified God, but because you're seeing the essence of the person themselves that transcends the personality and the ego. So,
well, you know, the whole mystical... I'm sorry.
No, I was done.
all the mystics say that the mystical experience has to do with locating, identifying that external divine and discovering that it's not external at all. It's internal and indwelling. And so I think yours is a really beautiful refinement or redaction or refraction is what I want to say of that those words from Baha'u'llah. Nice.
Thanks. I was thinking, you know, I'm aware of that. I know many of you who are on the call tonight, and maybe it's not really very a good idea for me to call and ask individuals if you'd like to say anything to this concept, but I see that my friend Dean Lawrence Carter, who is the dean of the Martin Luther King Chapel at Morehouse College, is with us on the call tonight, and I know that there's one more topic that we'd like to cover that Charles Nolly referred to, and it had to do with understanding the concept of forgiveness but reconciling it with the notion of justice. And I think that this is very important because there's a lot of debate and perception in the community that somehow forgiveness is giving permission to the wrongdoing of others or making it okay that something terrible has happened to a people or to an individual in the context of history or any other way. And that, I think, is the notion that we actually have to avoid because it has more to do with establishing that forgiveness is more for the forgiver than the one who is forgiven. And its purpose might be in order to establish by forgiveness the ability to see clearly the actual problem related to the act that was committed. And therefore, in clear-sightedness, justice can be done. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot, Dean Carter, but I know that Martin Luther King, and you've got quite a knowledge of King and Gandhi and great other peacemakers of our time, that this notion of the reconciliation of forgiveness and justice was something that Dr. King was one of the greatest proponents of in our time. I wondered if you would mind making a comment about that now.
Well, I can say right off my cuff that for Martin Luther King Jr., justice, he said, is love equally distributed. But in order to be able to practice or to exemplify, to demonstrate, manifest, or actualize that kind of unconditional, all-conditional, or agape love, you have to, one, be willing to suffer, and you have to recognize the divinity and the humanity in everybody, even your oppressors, and you have to be willing to engage in soft power or dialogue. And the most difficult part is that you have to be able to not be attached to the outcome or to expectations, lest you will certainly be a candidate for bitterness and anger. And so a tremendous amount of patience is required in seeking justice, and you never win the war, you win a battle, which gives you an opportunity to get to a new plateau from which to fight another struggle the next day. It's always a win-win situation that you're seeking. You're not trying to win against anybody. You know, I win, you lose. But you're seeking always to improve the situation. And you're trying to understand the pain and the hurt of the other person, which means that you're trying to hear them, not just on the factual level, but on the feeling level. And so this all gets into a capacity to listen. And when you're talking interracially, you've got cultural styles of turn-taking and turn-yielding that are different. It takes a very peace-oriented person. If peace is total freedom for the individual, then that means that you can't be distracted or arrested easily by what's passing in your experience.
Yeah. That's very true, and the one thing that I've learned, because we've studied this within the context of our Gandhi King's Season for Nonviolence, is that one of King's basic principles that I always felt was one of the truest and most insightful pieces of wisdom that I've ever gained, is that he encouraged those involved in serious nonviolent struggles to understand that the problem, that the issue had to do with the problem and not the person. So he encouraged people to make very clear distinction between looking at the issue, which was, if it was a question of injustice, it had to be dealt with very objectively, very seriously. But that didn't necessarily mean that there was something evil or demonic or bad about the person.
Exactly.
And I thought that was very useful. And it goes back to our discussion that we'll wrap up now about Baha'i and Charles Nolly's interview, that the mainsprings of the Baha'i teachings are about oneness and unity and interconnectedness, and that it's a religion, as many of us, I think, on this call and in this conference will agree, that embraces the diversity of our traditions full force because of their treasures and their richness. But understanding that in terms of the dialogue that we're having about the evolution of religion and spirituality in the 21st century, that there's an understory that gets to the fact that we're getting closer and closer to understanding that there is a source of all of the richness and diversity of this tradition that we all somehow are part of. We're all woven into the same fabric together, and that Charles does make the point in his interview that we're living in an age where the oneness of our human family and expressed in diversity is accelerating in our age, so that it's becoming more and more apparent, and with it comes the challenges of that kind of accelerated evolution of civilization. And I really felt that was an enormously important point in the interview. Jim, did you want to wrap up with any comments before we moved on to the next interview?
That's good, and I really echo what Lauren said. I really appreciate his contribution. He nailed it.
Very much so. Does anyone else want to make a contribution at this point? I can see your hands pop up if you press 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, good. Yeah, thanks a lot, Lawrence, for contributing in that way. I see we have a couple of questions or comments. Michael Moran. Hi, Michael.
It was good to hear Dr. Carter's voice. As I was listening and thinking about forgiveness, what kept coming to mind was that anything that we do or somebody does to us that is hurtful It's always done out of ignorance. And we, you know, if we really knew who we really were and who they really were, we could not do something that was harmful to another person, because we truly are all one. And the image that came to my mind was of Jesus on the cross. And all of the great religions teach forgiveness. But for Jesus, that was really a cornerstone of his ministry, that nothing was possible without that. You couldn't move forward without forgiveness. And when he was on the cross, as the story goes, and he's looking down at his tormentors, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." He was forgiving their ignorance. And that has always struck me when I'm struggling with forgiveness for somebody, and I remember that it's not the person that I need to forgive, it's the ignorance. They don't know any better, and therefore I can forgive that and hopefully move on. So those are just the thoughts that were coming to my mind as I was listening.
That's nice,
now,
Michael.
That's
Thank
lovely.
You. Jim.
Thank you, Michael. One more comment before we move on, and that's from Ginger Charles.
I have a question I'd like to pose rather than a comment. And again, I've seen evidence within myself concerning this issue about forgiveness this week. But I guess I was looking at this at a larger scale in regards to forgiveness in the Middle East and wondering, you know, there's some really great statements about this, but maybe I'm a simpleton, or I'm looking at this from a basic level of how do we all then take it out into the community? And I'm wondering if you all would discuss that, about ways that you begin to take that out into the community, because you can certainly go by example, but what's the how-to or the cookbook that some of you would suggest in taking it out into the community about seeking forgiveness, since it is such a self-directed task?
Well, that's a good question. I remember that story. Jim, you remember this too, that when we were working on the Parliament in 93, and I think this kind of speaks to Ginger's question, that toward, as we got closer to the event, we were getting, I would say, lobbied by leaders of many traditions that actually wanted us to appoint them to the final keynote speech at the big final celebration in Grant Park at the end of the Parliament. And we heard more than once that their right to that position was because they represented the tradition on the planet that had been most oppressed throughout history. And we got to the point where we were thinking, well, it's stand in line, because what religion wasn't most oppressed throughout history? So I'm just thinking that forgiveness might have something to do with understanding that it is kind of, you know, most recently it was the Sikhs, and at another time it was the Christians, and another time it was, you know, so that forgiveness is sort of like, I see in you what I see in myself and all other human beings and all other traditions, is the ability to, out of ignorance, as Michael just pointed out, create circumstances that are very detrimental to other people or other situations. So when we think about the Middle East, it's such an intractable kind of a conflict, and it's in many ways a family conflict too, and I think that, you know, maybe that's one possible angle of looking at it. Jim?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think actually this is a nice moment to segue into the conversation with Rabbi Levi Wyman Kelman from Jerusalem. Is that all right?
Yeah, definitely.
And I should say that Levi will be with us. And he's a member of the Peace Council. He is the rabbi. He's from New York and raised in Chicago, and a good American Jewish family from a long line of rabbis. His grandfather and father are famous rabbis, or were famous rabbis in Chicago. And he went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison and then took Aliyah and went up to Israel. And now is the senior rabbi at the largest Reform congregation in Israel, which is not saying a lot since most Israelis are Orthodox. But he's also one of the founders of Rabbis for Human Rights and a major figure in the Israeli peace process. And I just had the pleasure in May of hosting Levi and his wife Paula, who are long, long time friends here in Chicago or in nearby Chicago for some conversations about all of this. And one of the things that we talked about, and one of the things that I talked to Leiby in the interview a couple of years ago about, was the whole idea of redemptive violence versus restorative justice. And that's what's coming up here. I think this also has resonated. Ginger, I'm speaking to you now. I think this has resonated in an awful lot of your really rich contributions to these conversations. We all grow up with a sort of built-in, fundamental cultural narrative of redemptive violence, which means that there's somebody that needs killing. There's a bad guy, and Shane rides into town, or Clint Eastwood rides into town, or John Wayne does it. The Westerns are filled with it, but so too are our epic stories like Star Wars and so on. Our mythic tales are filled with the idea of redemptive violence, the violence that redeems and restructures and fixes things. And a wonderful theologian that we have referred you to often, who sadly passed away a couple of years ago, Walter Wink, who wrote a number of books. One was The Powers That Be. Many of his books have the word powers in them, and they're well worth exploring. Anyway, he introduced this idea of the distinction between the narrative of redemptive violence. Somebody needs killing or violence needs to be done, and we're all better when it's done, and restorative justice. And restorative justice is a two-way street. It means things have to be put back in place on both sides of the street. And that's what justice really means, not revenge. As Sally King pointed out in one of our early interviews, and we talked about the interview with her a few weeks ago, she pointed out that from a Buddhist perspective, justice often seems to mean something like revenge. And I think all too often for us in the West, justice does mean revenge. But when Walter Wink talks about restorative justice, it's not revenge at all. And so Leiby Kelman says part of the interesting process of dialogue often centers around Israelis talking about wanting peace and Palestinians talking about wanting justice, but there also turns out to be a Jewish claim for justice. Both sides see themselves as victims, and they demand justice for the other side, from the other side. As long as it's stated in absolute terms, we're going to really stay stuck. There can be no solution here that will provide absolute justice for both sides. Leiby often says this, I'm going to interrupt and interject this. He says, this is not a story with an all-around happy ending. There's going to be a lot of disappointed folks on both sides. And that's very hard for either side, I'm going back to his interview, to let go of. It's hard for both sides to understand the other side's demand for justice. And he says, but justice is one of the things that motivates us at Rabbis for Human Rights, which is not popular among the Israeli public. We define ourselves as a Zionist organization that demands that Israel be as just a society as possible. So I think that's really powerful. He believes very strongly, and he and I have had this conversation a million times, that the idea of redemptive violence has to fade in Israel, in the Middle East, and around the world. And the idea of restorative justice, fixing things, making things as much better as possible, is critical. I'll tell you another major advocate of that, is Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who spoke constantly about the idea of restorative justice. You can't fix it all, but redemptive violence will never get us anywhere. And at the core, at the heart of restorative justice, as I think Lawrence Carter was suggesting, is forgiveness. Without forgiveness, you can't even get started.
That's absolutely right. What were some of the other key things in Leiby's interview that struck you?
Well, I think two other things, if I may. I'll try to be quick about them. One, I asked him, which will prevail? This is actually related. Which will prevail, religious fundamentalism or pluralism? I hope you're getting the sense from Levy Kelman, and you'll meet him and you'll love him, and his wife Paula will be there. She'll be a videographer helping us keep a record of all of this. You'll love these folks, but you get a sense that he's sort of like, well, there's two sides to the story. He's a rabbi, and he says, my whole worldview is infused by a sense of hope. So I certainly believe, though I have no way to justify this rationally, that what we're all seeing is the last gasp of religious extremism and fundamentalism, and that forces of dialogue and openness will prevail. This is very much, of course, in the spirit of our theme of the evolution of religion and spirituality. He says, if I open my eyes and look around my neighborhood, I know that's not really true. In Israeli society, the voices of religious extremism just keep getting stronger, and by playing to the most primitive, legitimate fears that people have, they're able to galvanize support in a way that those of us who talk in terms of religious pluralism are not. I'm aware of that situation, but I also feel very strongly that a small group of committed people can have tremendous power to shape things. Even if we don't have the numbers, if we can somehow articulate a message that conveys hope and love and respect for the other, I believe that that message can prevail.
See, that's what's so powerful about it and about all of the people who will be at this conference is that there's, make no mistake about it, they are realists because they're also activists, and many of them have been in the trenches for decades. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that they've given up on their vision. And I think that that's one of the most important things that us, that all of us from our various traditions bring, is this idea that although it may not look like that next door or today, we still hold the vision that this is true and can be true. Otherwise, you know, might as well give up. And I, before we move on to the Global Manifesto for today's call, I wanted to just close up Levy's interview by talking for a minute about his notion that is very close to what we've been referring to around this conference as spiritually motivated social action or spiritually motivated social engagement. The idea that he was making it clear that that the relationship between our spirituality and our activism, even political activism, is and should be a very close relationship for any number of reasons. We probably can't get into that discussion right now, but that there is something about a person who has undertaken social challenges to really put themselves in the mix and try to make a difference, that when that person comes equipped with a spiritual practice that is profound and that they're very true to, that those people seem to have less burnout because their activism is coming from a deeper place. It's not cosmetic. It's not from the outside in. It's not in reaction to an issue, but it's a genuine human response that comes out of a cultivated spiritual practice. And that to me, if I come away from today's call or even from the whole conference with nothing but that notion embedded in me, I think it would be worth it.
Yeah, I think so too. That's great.
Let's go on to the Global Manifesto, the Brundtland Report that we looked at for this tutorial.
Well, I know we're winding down, but let me just say that one of the things that excites me the most about this whole process and about these tutorials and the way they've been constructed, and that I'm happiest that we've built into it all, is this introduction to some of the really powerful declarative statements, conference manifestos, and that sort of thing. Since we're talking about offering up a charter for engaged spirituality for the 21st century, people say, well, you know, what does it mean? What's the worth of another declaration and so on? Well, what we've tried to do is put together some declarations that have really made a difference. And I'll tell you, if you've attended to this or if you go back and look through and acquaint yourself with these declarations and come to the conference armed with that, I think it will make a huge difference. But one of the most important is the report of the Brundtland, Brundtland Commission. And that commission was convened by Javier Perez de Cuellar, Secretary General of the UN, way back in 1983. And he appointed the then Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Harlem Brundtland, to head up that commission. They then would offer up 4 years later the Brundtland Report, their main report was called Our Common Future. That would go on, I'll just tell you, to have a powerful influence on the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992, and the follow-up conference, the third UN conference on environment and development that was held in Johannesburg, South Africa, in 2002. And one of the most important things that I'll come back to in a moment about that report is it really did offer us our first definition of sustainable development. And it's with this conference and this group and this work, the commission, the Brundtland Commission, that sustainable development comes into our vocabulary. I just want to say a word or two about that in a moment. I will say one more thing. Gro Harlem Brundtland is a woman. She was born in 1939. She served three terms as Prime Minister of Norway. She was head of the World Health Organization, and now she serves as a special envoy of the UN on climate change. Very much active, one of the key figures in evolutionary change. And it turns out, a story has just recently come to global attention in the last several months, that last summer's attack in Norway on the Liberal Party by Anders Breivik, you know, 93 people killed on the island and so on, and more killed in Stockholm. Actually, the principal target, Breivik has told us, of that attack was Gro Harlem Brundtland, who had just finished her address when he arrived, having been delayed by one thing and another, when he arrived at the island and opened fire and killed 93 people. She was the principal intended victim. That's something I hadn't known. I just learned in the last couple of weeks. Let me just say about sustainable development, and I'll shut up, that the definition of sustainable development that the Brundtland Commission offered brought together two concepts. On the one hand, needs, and on the other hand, limits. And keeping that in mind, there are needs that must be met, and what's really fascinating is that this group in 1997, in their document, Our Common Future, said that the principal needs we had to be concerned with were the needs of the poor, of the world's poorest people, and they should be given overwhelming priority. I'm thinking of Father Gonzalo Ituarte of the Dominican Order of Mexico, listening and hearing there the liberation theological notion of a preferential option for the poor. All things being equal, where do you put your energies? You put them towards the poor. And the Brundtland Commission said that. One half of sustainable development is needs, basic and essential needs, economic growth, and so on, but to meet the needs of the world's poorest. And then the idea of limitations imposed by technology and the environment, population, and so on. What are the limits? What are the possibilities? And what are we trying to do? What's sustainable development? They're also the first to introduce the idea that a real environmental future had to think ahead in terms, or plan, had to think ahead in terms of the next generation and the next and the next. And so this is a critical contribution that has really influenced our thinking. And I'd like just to take a moment to call on our colleague to whom we turned from time to time here and who will be with us in Italy, James Quilligan, who spoke to us last time, I think, about the Brundt Report, but who knows everything there is to know about the Brundtland Commission as well. James, do you have an insight or two? He'll need a microphone.
Hello?
Hello?
James.
Okay, we can hear you.
Yes, thanks. One of the things I think that's very important about Brundtland is that it introduced the idea of intergenerational justice. So it's about meeting the needs of the poor in the present, but it's also about meeting the ability of future generations to meet their own needs, which is very, very critical. So, in other words, we're worried about the poor now, but we should also be worried about the poor in the future, particularly as the limits that Jim referred to bear down on us, the limits to forced on us by the environment, by technology, by politics, social organization. So it's a big challenge, and the concept of intergenerational justice really, it's in the political realm, was launched by the Brundtland Report, and I think it's a very interesting concept, because now we get the dimension where we really have to account for, or that we're responsible for, what is going to take place in the future, whereas in the past, in the old economic model, we really didn't care about that. So the two things that we look to in the future are, what is the state of the environment going to be, but also how is that going to impact on society?
And it really does bring up the whole seven generations idea, doesn't it, James?
Yeah, very much. In fact, I think people are looking even beyond seven generations. I think that with climate change, we're realizing that even if we reduced carbon emissions into the atmosphere, it could take 1,000 years for us to get back to a stable level. So we're really looking at very long-term possibilities here. Of course, that means that the economic system also has to adjust to those long-term horizons. But at the same time, we can take heart that, you know, Brundtland launched this, and as you said, Rio, and then Rio Plus 10 and Rio Plus 20 came about. Also, the Brundtland was really therefore responsible for the development of Agenda 21, which is a very important document, and also
right.
The Earth Charter, which a lot of people know about.
Yeah, that's
great.
That's great to know, because our next week, our module number 7, the theme is nature, and the spiritual tradition that we're looking at is indigenous traditions, which of course came up, that I know of, with the seventh generation notion, and also the Earth Charter is our global manifesto, so you've kind of nailed those right on the head. Yeah, wow, there's so much to think. Are there any other questions or comments from our group at large here? That was just, thank you so much, James. Anybody else have a question or a comment before we wind up? Okay. That's good. How about you, Jim? Any closing thoughts?
No, it's just, I just have to say the menu is so rich.
I know, but I think, you know, even I feel I'm overwhelmed by the amount of information and the complexity of information, but it's not just information. I mean, we're using more than our intellectual capacities here, I hope. I speak for others, not myself. But the idea that there's so much to understand and learn on so many levels, and yet I still feel that these tutorials have sort of helped us ease into the fact that you don't have to know everything about all of this material. It's a way of practicing the conversation in a way. I think we're just modeling our ability to contribute, to think about, to be, you know, critical thinkers in this age, and also to keep our hearts open. So in that way, I think it's getting more and more comprehensible. Anyway, so 2 weeks from tonight, we'll be meeting here again. There are just 3 of these left, believe it or not. It's really been a nice journey. So I just expect that we hope to see all of you here, all of you back here again in 2 weeks, and wanted to remind you that tomorrow at 1 p.m. Pacific time, we'll be having our Italian lesson with Silvio Danio, and he'll deliver some more phrases tomorrow morning, and I'll send those all off to you. So I guess that's about it, and thank you all for being here once again.
Thank you.
Have a good
thank
night.
You all.
Take care. Bye-bye.